Bernard Revel, and he's been a visiting professor in Israel and in Yale and in Harvard, and he's very well known, and we're very excited. We've been trying to get him for 2 years. We're very excited that he's joining us, and without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Dr. Schneerlein.
Thank you, Chaim, for the kind words of introduction. Basically, what I'd like to do this evening is to discuss with you a very difficult passage in rabbinic literature. So if you go to the first page in front of you, we won't waste much time, and we'll go immediately to the difficult passage that we need to explore together. Masechet Avodah Zarah, the tractate devoted to all the rules and regulations relating to idolatry, begins in its first Mishnah by saying, "Lifnei Eideihem Shel Hagoyim," 3 days before the festivals of the idolaters, a Jew may do no business with idolaters, lest the idolater use the gain or be delighted with the profit that he made and use that profit toward bringing offerings to the idol on whatever festival was being celebrated. So 3 days before a pagan festival, Jews can do no business with pagans. That's a Mishnah, it's halacha lemaaseh. We're not here to decide halachic issues. Technically, Christianity comes under this category as well, so in theory, 3 days before Christmas, if you like, Jews should be doing no business with Christians. There's actually another view, another opinion in that same Mishnah, Rabbi Shmuel. We don't decide according to Rabbi Shmuel, but there are some people who are very pious and follow Rabbi Shmuel as well. He says 3 days after a pagan festival, you can't do any business with Christians, with pagans. Some Rishonim held that Christianity comes under this category, and that created incredible difficulty because Sunday is considered a festival of the pagans and the Christians. Therefore, 3 days before Sunday, you could do no business with Christians. 3 days after Sunday, you couldn't do any business with Christians. It created some difficulty for Jews. But we're not going to concern ourselves with that particular issue. The Mishnah then goes on, later in that same chapter, the first chapter of Avodah Zarah, to list the pagan festivals by name, so that one would know on regarding which festivals 3 days before you can do no business with pagans. And the page you have in front of you, Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, picks up on that Mishnah that lists the names of the festivals, and one of the festivals is Yom Genusya Shel Malchehem. So, if you have it in front of you, where you see the brackets on the page, that's the passage that's going to interest us immediately. And I'm going to read it the way I learned it in Yeshiva. I hope you can follow along. I will not use Sephardic pronunciation for the Gemara. I'll use it for modern Hebrew whenever I have to quote a modern Hebrew passage. Yom Genusya Shel Malchehem, my Yom Genusya Shel Malchehem. What does this mean? Which festival does the Mishnah have in mind? Omer Rav Yehuda Yom Shem Amidim Bo Ovdei Kochavim Es Malkom. So Rav Yehuda said that this refers to the day that a king presumably is appointed, perhaps inaugurated. So the day when pagans appoint or inaugurate their king, that day is a pagan festival. Tanya, so the Gemara says, but we learned in a Braisa, we learned in another passage other than the Mishnah, a Tanaitic passage. Tanya, Yom Genusya, V'yom Shemamidin Bo Es Malkom. We learned in another passage that there are two festivals. One is called Yom Genusya, and the other is called the day when they appoint or inaugurate their king. So clearly, Yom Ginus Yoshem Achei must be referring to something else. Lo Kasha, the Gemara answers, there's no problem. There are two festivals that are listed here. Hodi Dei, Hodi Vred. There's one festival when a king is appointed to be king. And there's another festival when the king has his son crowned during his lifetime. When a king is able to crown his son as his successor, that's another festival. That's what's referred to as Yom Ginusya, the second holiday. The Gemara continues, Umi Mukme Malka Bar Malka. And since when do we see that pagans have one king followed by his son as successor? What's behind this question and is a given, and I want to be sure we understand what the Gemara takes for granted, and the Gemara has every right to take it for granted, and we're talking about the Romans. The Mishnah is written in the Roman period. Rome is a pagan country with a pagan religion, and the Gemara is asking, since when, where have we seen that Roman rulers are a succession of son following the father? Mimukme Malka Bar Malka. Moreover, we have a proof that it can't be so, for Tane Rav Yosef. And the point of departure for Rav Yosef's comment is a verse in Ovadia. Those of you who remember your Ovadia, it's only one chapter. The entire Ovadia is devoted to Edom. It's Masa Edom. It refers to a nation called Edom. And many of you will know that in the Gemara, Edom is the standard terminology for Rome. Edom is identified with Rome. So the Gemara says, the verse says, regarding Edom, Hine katon misaticha bagoyim, and the end of the verse, which follows shortly later in the Gemara, Bozui atoma'od, it's a verse that says that you are the smallest of the nations, and you are Bazui ma'od, you are denigrated, and so on, very much so. The Gemara darshins, Atani Rabbi Yosef, Hine katon misaticha bagoyim, why are you the smallest of the least of the nations? She'ein Moshivin Melech Ben Melech. Unlike other foreign nations where the son succeeds the father as king, in Rome this is not the case. Of course, the reference here is to what's well known. What's the reference to? To the Roman Caesars, who are appointed by the Senate, where son does not succeed the father in most instances. So you are the least of the nations. This was a nice rabbinic pun on the Romans, denigrating the Roman system of government. She'ein Moshivin Melech Ben Melech. You don't have a son succeed a father. Bazui Atama'od, and you are the most despised of the nations. She'ein Lahem Loksav V'lo Lashon. You are so despised, so destitute, if you like, that you have neither script nor language. So the Gemara. And of course, as far as the Gemara is concerned, this is all interesting only for one purpose, namely that apparently we've misidentified the pagan festivals, because if one of the pagan festivals, Yom Ginusya, means when a son succeeds a father, we have no such practice among the Romans. It doesn't fit in. That's the Gemara's problem. I'm not here to solve that particular problem in the Gemara. I'm interested in the phrase we just read, that Edom, understood by the Gemara here as being equal to Rome, the Romans have neither script nor language. It's very strange. So we need Rashi's help, and I underlined Rashi for you to see what this means. And I'm only interested in the Rashi, the third of the wide lines at the bottom of the page. Ksavaloshon shoromiyim me'umo acheres bo'alahem. Rashi here engages in this kind of antiquarian study. Rashi tells us that you should know that the script and the language of the Romans came to them from some other nation. It's not original with the Romans. They borrowed it from some other nation. Fair enough. And that's how Rashi understands this drash in the Gemara, that they have neither script. Of course they have a script, and of course they have a language. But they borrowed that script and language from some other nation. Then Rashi continues, Acherim Tiknu lahem kol sifrehem. Others wrote all their books. Now I have tremendous problems with this Rashi, and that's the real problem I want to raise with you now. My first problem is Romans don't have a script and a language. Anyone here went to school? Certainly went to college, took a course in classics. And even if you didn't take a course in classics, you're all aware, you all heard of Cicero, and you all heard of Ovid, and we have wonderful Latin poetry, verse, and so on. Romans didn't have a script, and Romans didn't have a language. Okay, so I sort of answered that already. What, as Rashi says, what it really means is not that they didn't have a script and language. They borrowed it. Let's say they borrowed the alphabet from the Greeks, which ultimately they did, if not directly, indirectly. The Greeks borrowed the alphabet from the Phoenicians, as you well know. And the Phoenician alphabet is the same as our alphabet. Romans inherited a form of the Greek alphabet, which we call the Latin alphabet, and we Americans have borrowed the Latin alphabet, and we use it for writing English. So there's a long history of the alphabet being borrowed from one nation, from a previous nation. Ad hayom hazeh. Okay, let's say that's the case. But Rashi says, Acherim titnu lahem kol sifrehem. Others wrote their books for them. That's a gratuitous insult. Others wrote their books. Let's say, Naniach, I'm willing to admit that the script is borrowed. I'm even willing to admit that the Roman language, Latin, was a language that was borrowed from, let's say, the Etruscans, if that's the case. Let's, I'm willing to admit that, even though historically it's not quite correct. But others wrote their books for them? Cicero? We have endless Latin writings. The Low Classical Library wouldn't exist if not for for all these Latin writings that they produced in critical editions. Aside from which, as I say, this is a gratuitous insult. There's nothing in the passage, there's nothing in the Gemara that requires Rashi to say this. The verse that's cited says they have neither script nor language. Fine, so Rashi explained how the Romans have neither script nor language. But there's no reason to move beyond that and say that others wrote their books for them. To say there's no trigger in the Gemara that leads to this particular conclusion on the part of Rashi. So that's a mystery that I want to present to you immediately, and I hope tonight we can solve the plain sense of this text of Rashi. Incorporated in the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo, our official code of law, Orach Chaim Siman Tuf Kaf Tei, look it up, is a paragraph that almost all of us skip. We rarely look at it. We don't look at it because none of us follows it, many of them. Which itself is an interesting question. Why are there paragraphs in the Shulchan Aruch that nobody reads? Or if they read them, nobody observes them. One of them is in Shulchan Aruch Orach Chaim, which is that part of the Shulchan Aruch, presumably, that deals with everyday life. The earliest version of this list goes back to the 8th century of the Common Era. So I'm going to ask you to turn to passage 2 in front of you, which is the oldest copy of that list. You'll say, this is a Siman in the Shulchan Aruch. And you're looking at the 8th century version, the oldest one we have. It does not appear in the Talmud. It's post-Talmudic, so far as we know. But it's pre-Gaonic, as it were. It's quite an interesting list. Please read through it while I'm talking, if you like. It lists yahrzeits of famous biblical and rabbinic heroes. And it's presented as a list of fast days, commemorative fast days, that all Jews ought to fast on these days, on these yahrzeits of famous biblical heroes, or rabbinic heroes, as the case may be. The list itself is somewhat mysterious, and there are a whole series of questions that one needs to put to this text that you're looking at right now, this passage 2. Well, some of the obvious questions are, who authored this list? It's not in the Talmud. When was it authored? Where was it authored? What's its provenance? What is its zitz in Laban, its place in life? Who would make such lists?
Where do we find people who make lists of yard sites, and so on? One has a lot of other questions. How accurate is this list? Did these people really die on the days that are mentioned here? And why were these people selected to have the yard sites commemorated, and many others were not selected to have the yard sites commemorated? Anybody here who learns Gemara will know we have hundreds of Tanaim and Amoraim. Some of the leading figures are nowhere mentioned in this list, and others are. The question is why. This list has the yard site of Nadav and Avihu, truly important biblical heroes, but it doesn't mention Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, who were also Shomer Shabbos, and merited their yard sites being commemorated. So these are some of the obvious questions that need to be raised by anyone who studies Shulchan Aruch, and certainly this particular paragraph. Aside from the various historical questions, literary questions that need to be raised regarding this paragraph, this text is replete with halachic problems as well. Take a look at the first line. You don't have to look very far. It says, Elu yomim shemisanin bahem min haTorah. These are days upon which a Jew must fast by Torah obligation. We call it the Oraisa. By Torah obligation, you have to fast on these days. Where? I haven't seen yet a list of the 613 commandments that includes a mitzvah that you must fast on a yard site. And certainly not these yard sites. So, as I say, there are halakhic questions. If you look at some of the dates, you'll see that some of the fasts fall on the first day of Nisan. It says here, Bishmini b'Nisan, but in many of the variant texts, it reads one Nisan for the first of these fast days. There's a fast day listed here for Hanukkah, for the 28th day of Kislev. Anyway, in other words, there are fast days listed on Rosh Chodesh. The first day of Nisan is Rosh Chodesh. There are fast days that are listed on Hanukkah, at the end of this month, the month of Kislev. And the Mishnah bans fasting, either on Rosh Chodesh or on the Jew is not allowed to fast on Rosh Chodesh or on Chanukah. It's a famous Mishnah, Sechas Tanis, Ein Gozrin Tanis, Alat Tzibur, B'Rosh Chodesh, B'Chanukah, B'Purim. So, not only is this a strange paragraph in the Shulchan Aruch, which no one observes, I have yet to meet a Jew who fasts on these days, unless he's fasting all year, anyway, but as a matter of fact, halakhically, you're not allowed to fast on some of these days. So it's a very strange paragraph. And perhaps typical of the enigmatic status of this paragraph that you have in front of you is the following comment by Rabbi Yosef Karo. And I'm reading now from the Beis Yosef, from Rabbi Yosef Karo's comment on the tour, which is really his magnum opus, his greatest work. The Shulchan Aruch is only an abridgment of the Beis Yosef. And in the tour, when this paragraph is bored, the Beis Yosef says as follows, listen carefully, and as a Sfaradi, now I will read this Sfaradi Hebrew, I'm quoting this Sfaradi, Lo reiti me'olam ve'lo shamati mi shenahag litanot b'hem. But Yosef Karo says, I never met anybody who fasts on these days. U'be'emet yesh litmoa al mi shetiknam, and one has to be astounded at whoever made this list. Heyach tikein ksatam litanot b'Rosh Chodesh. How could he possibly list fast days on Rosh Chodesh, which mishneiachly is prohibited? And what's even more astounding for us, and I just raised a question here, and it's not my concern this evening, is after you heard what Beit Yosef had to say, he incorporated this in the Shulchan Aruch Arachayim forever as a canonical law. And it's, you open up your Mishnah Berurah, it's right there. Nobody cut it out. It's still there. Shulchan Aruch Hayim, Siman Tav Kuf Pei. That's just introduction. Now we really get to the problem that we need to solve. Now, look at the list. I underlined what would be approximately line 67, I guess, or perhaps precisely line 67 in the text in front of you. We're talking about the month of Teveit. And the text reads, as you can see, B'tisha bo, on the ninth day of Teveit, is a fast day. Lo katvu raboteinu amahu. The rabbis did not explain why. It's a fast day without an explanation. It is the only fast day listed on this list. If you have a chance to read it as I'm talking, it's the only one for which no reason is provided. There are later formulations of this list. The formulation changes slightly, even for this line, but the content of the line never changes. This day is a fast day. The ninth day of Tevet is a fast day. Notice the eighth day is a fast day. The ninth day is a fast day. And of course, we all know that Asarah B'Tevet is a fast day. So we have three consecutive fast days, which might be one of the reasons why not too many people follow this paragraph. Okay. What I want to do briefly is survey with you some of the best suggestions that have been put forward through the generations. So if you'll turn to page 3. These are all different Rishonim and Acharonim who wrestled with this mysterious fast day, the fast day of the ninth of Tevet. The first rabbinic scholar to address the historical issue, why do we fast on this day, was the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud. Not the Ravid that everyone here knows from the Rambam, but the Ravid, the historian and philosopher, the author of Sefer HaKabbalah, and the author of the famous philosophic work, the Emunah Harama, the Exalted Faith. This Ravid died in 1180, he lived in Spain. And in his famous historical work, Sefer HaKabbalah, and you have the passage in front of you, passage 3. So page 3, passage 3 at the top of the page, where he presents a vivid portrayal of Rabbi Yosef Halevi Hanagid. You all are familiar with Shmuel Hanagid, that famous rabbinic scholar, poet, general, the Kissinger of the 11th century. Advisor to the kings of Spain and so on. So Shmuel HaNagid was succeeded by his son Yosef HaLevi. Yosef HaLevi also served as vizier of Granada, and he was murdered on the ninth day of Tevet, 1066. On the ninth day of Tevet in the year 1066. And so we can take a look now at the writing passage. And he records that we all know that on the ninth day of Tevet in the year 1066, everywhere, Jews world over mourn the death of Rabbi Yosef HaLevi HaNagid, and even before he was assassinated, before he was murdered by an Arab due to political intrigue, even before that, the rabbis already hinted that this would happen. They wrote a scroll of fast. The reference is to our list that you have on page 2. The rabbis wrote there will be a fast day, that everyone has to fast on the ninth day of Tevet. They didn't explain why. Now we know why. Because of this event that occurred in the year 1066. Now this suggestion has, in a certain sense, merit. Our list is, if you look at the list of the yard sites, there are many martyrs on our list. Our list is a list of almost a martyrology, you could call it. And so the day of death, and it's certainly the day of the death of a Jewish martyr, is appropriate for our list. And the Ravid actually solves a wonderful problem. He solves why the rabbis didn't spell out why we fast on this day. Because imagine if they would have written on this day, Yosef HaLevi HaNagid will be assassinated in the year 1066. Or well, even if they didn't give the year. You could imagine how Yosef HaLevi HaNagid would have felt every year as this day neared. So they could not, of course, explain why this was a fast day. Nonetheless, I have to admit that even if we concede the gift of prophecy to the author of passage 2, to this list of fasts, there's a major flaw in the Ravid's suggestion, and this flaw is really revealed by all of Jewish history, and that is our list is much too short. If the rabbis were going to commemorate the date of deaths of famous people, the people who would be martyred after the rabbis made the list, there are just too many famous people missing from this list. Gedolim, Beethoven, Yosef HaLevi HaNagid died at the hands of martyrs, and needless to say, an endless number of famous Gedolim died in the Khmelnytsky massacres, and Holocaust and so on, Wacharim Wasserman and so on, they're not on the list. So there are too many people missing from this list to take seriously this suggestion of the writer. But it's a good try. It gets an A for effort. We go to the next, and you'll see, obviously, those who came after the Rebbe were not persuaded. That's why we have more suggestions. So we will move to passage 4, the Ramah, the Moshe Isserles, the Ashkenazi contribution to the Shulchan Aruch, as we have it. So the Ramah, writing in the 16th century, he died in 1572. He wrote a commentary on Megillat Esther, and you have the passage in front of you from his commentary on Megillat Esther. And the Ramah noticed that in Esther 2:16, chapter 2, verse 16, the verse tells us that Esther was taken to Achashverosh, El Beit Malchuto, Bachodesh Ha'asiri, he was taken in the 10th month, Hu Chodesh Tevet. That's what we're told. We hear that every year, but none of us really remembers it, because who cares when Esther was taken? It adds nothing to the story, and if it was Adar, if it was another month, who cares when she was taken? She was taken. But somehow, for some reason, the Megillah wanted us to know that she was taken in the month of Tevet. And of course, as you can see in front of you, you look at passage 4, what essentially the Ramah suggests is that the reason the Megillah was telling us that she was taken in the month of Tevet was to reveal to us that that was a very sad day, that this woman was forced, as it were, to become Achashverosh's wife against her will. This was a sad day. It would be commemorated as a fast day, and in fact it occurred on the 9th day of Tevet, and that's what this fast day is really all about. So, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Here there are all sorts of weaknesses that come to mind. You can help me if you want to suggest some. Most obvious is the date isn't given. If this date was really significant, somehow the Megillah wanted to hint at the fact that she was taken on the 9th of Tevet, so Ikar Chaser Menasefer. The key point here is it's the 9th day of Tevet. It doesn't say that it was the 9th day of Tevet. The Megillah only tells me that it was in the month of Tevet. Moreover, if this is what the reason why we fast, so why is it a secret? Take a look at the list on passage 2, this famous passage, this Siman in the Shulchan Aruch, lists every fast day and gives the reason. Here it says, Lo katvu rabotenu al mahu. For some deliberate reason, the rabbis did not write why. Why not? So tell us. If this was the reason was that Esther was taken on the 9th day of Tevet to Hashverosh, and the Jews remembered this day as a tragic moment in Jewish history. Say so. So the passage 2 should have said, because Esther was taken on that day. There's no reason for the rabbis to omit the explanation. So we go to passage 5. We're still not satisfied. And now we come to the Taz. These are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo. We're moving into the 17th century. We're moving so quick in Jewish history. Here we have the Taz and the Magen Avraham. And they both say essentially the same thing. They're very surprised that this brisa, this list of fasts, says we don't know why we fast on the 9th of Tevet. Because they say, if you look, Tamar Dolahu, Ita B'Slichot, or Ita B'Slichot, take a look at the Slichos. We all say Slichos. We all say Kinos, and so on. Look at the Slichos that we say on Asara B'Teves, and you'll see that in the Slichos recited on the to this day, by the way, it's in our Slichos. It says that on the 9th of Tevet, Ezra died. It was Ezra's yard site on the 9th of Tevet. And the Magen Avraham says the same thing. Therefore, they're surprised that our text reads as it does. If you go back and look at the line that's on the line, it says, Lo katvu rabotenu al mahu. Why not? Anyway, Taz and Magen Avraham tell us that they're revealing to us, anyway, the reason why this was Ezra's yard site. But there's a fatal flaw with this suggestion as well. So, first of all, look at passage 2 carefully. Read the line, look at the entire line, let's say. Read together again, line 67, on page 2. Tisha bo lo katvu rabotenu amaru. The rabbis did not record why we fast on this day. Then it says, Vo bayom, meit Ezra ha-kohen, unechemya ben kachal. also on that day, this is a gloss. This is not explaining why the rabbis didn't tell us. The rabbis did not tell us why we fast on that day. Perhaps we don't know why we fast on that day. And then there's an additional gloss which says, and anyway, on that day, and also on that day, it happens to be the York side of Ezra and Ezra. That does not explain in the first half. That's an addition to the first half. The first half remains problematic. There's some reason why the rabbis did continue to fast on the ninth of Tevet. Whatever the reason was, they didn't tell us what it was. Finally, we go to a variant of passage 6, so we're back on page 3 now. We go to the 18th century, Rabbi Yonason Eibeschutz, his famous classic homiletic work, Yaros Brash, suggests sort of a variation on the theme of the Ezra solution. He says that really it doesn't mean that Ezra died on this day. Why didn't the rabbi spell out that Ezra died on this day? So he sort of explains that Ezra was the second Moses. And just as in the case of Moses, no one knows where Moses is buried, so too, in the case of Ezra, we don't know, the rabbi did not want the list to reveal on what day he died. Like Moses, the yard site is given as Zion Ador, so you should have listed the yard site for Ezra as well. So, not persuaded by the argument of the Mishnah. Aside from which, once again, why couldn't the rabbis just spell it out clearly and told us, Tisha Bal Nes Ezra, what's so terrible? This is the best of what's been said. Much more has been suggested. When the traditional avenues of interpretation were exhausted, yielding little or no results, Jewish scholars perforce turned elsewhere for illumination. For ultimately, interpret we must. We have a difficult text and we have to understand it. And this resulted in one of the most curious turn of events in Jewish intellectual history, namely the Christological interpretation of a Jewish text, which we will now have a sample. The great 19th century Jewish scholars, the founder of what's called the science of Judaism, Wissenschaft des Judentums, Leopold Solnitz, and many other famous scholars, Solomon Ben Rappaport, Chief Rabbi of Prague, Nehemia Brühl, all pointed to the Spanish philosopher and astronomer, his name was Abraham Barjia. If you'll take a look now at passage 7, Rabbi Abraham Barjia died in the year 1136. He was a great astronomer, a great philosopher. And he wrote in his book Sefer HaGibur, which was published for the first time in 1851, even though it was written in 1122, look at the passage he wrote. That the founder of Christianity was born on December 25th, Christmas. And he made a calculation, and he calculated that the year that the founder of Christianity was born, December 25th fell on the ninth day of Christmas. So in light of Avraham Barjia's calculation, the aforementioned 19th century scholars all concluded that the fast of the ninth of Tevet commemorated the Hebrew birthday of Yeshua. That the rabbis chose not to reveal the reason for their fast was a matter of prudence. You understand that. As rabbis were writing manuscripts, publishing books ultimately, once printing was invented, they weren't going to put in print, nor could they put in print. Fact that they had ordained a fast day among Jews commemorating the birthday of the founder of Christianity. So here we have an interesting explanation which coincided exactly with the ninth of Tevet. It also explained why the rabbis did not tell us the reason why we fast. It made sense in every way. And I must say, in light of these
three scholars whose names I mentioned and their suggestion, this has become the accepted explanation of a particular passage, our difficult passage of why he fasted on the ninth of Tevis. But there are too many questions that remain unanswered. I'm very troubled. I'm no more persuaded by this than by any of the other suggestions that were put forward. Why? First of all, did the author of passage 2, did the author of all these fasts, did he know that December 25th fell on the 9th of Tevis? It's very nice that Avraham Bar Chiya was an astronomer and he made a calculation and he was able to figure out that December 25th in the year, as we now know today, 3 BC, if you like, which is when he was really born, that year happened to fall on the 9th of Tevis. Very nice that a great mathematician and astronomer knew that. Did the author of our text know that? I don't know if he knew that or not. Would the author of a brisa, our list of fasts, would he take seriously the Christian claim that Yeshu was born on December 25th? Because that's where you have to start. You have to start where they say he was born. They say he was born on December 25th. Why believe that? Take a look at what Avraham Bar Chiya wrote. Let's read it together. Who nolad b'divreihem? They say he was born in the year 3761, Legriat Olam, Esrim v'chamisha yamim b'chodesh December. He was born on the 25th of December. Hu yom Shabbat, yom tisha b'tevet. That happened to be a Shabbos, and it happened to be the ninth day of Tevet. V'ra'uy haya hayom hazeh li'ivaleh bo harasha hazeh. It's a wonderful day that he should have been born on this day. Im divreihem emet. If it's true that he was born on December 25th, if I can believe them, then this is a perfect day because it happens to be it fell on the ninth day of Tevis, which is a fast day for all Jews. You see, it worked out perfectly. Im divreihem emet. Aval ein adam mamin le'divreihem. Look what Avraham Bar Chiya said. We don't believe then that he was really born on December 25th. Ein adam ma'amin le'divreihem ha'omrim aleidat ta'talui shehem yadu yoma. We don't believe then that they know what they Ki hadavar hazeh ino katuv lahem ve'evangelayon. Oh, we once had hachamim that knew the New Testament backwards and forwards. Avraham Bar Chiya says, you know, you can read the New Testament. Nowhere in the New Testament does it say that Yeshu was born on December 25th. He's absolutely right. It's a big bucket. Not a word about it, except you in the New Testament. Why should I believe them that they have a tradition that he was born on December 25th? And as a matter of fact, I can tell you that before the 4th century of the Common Era, there were many, many different traditions. 12, 13, 14 different dates that were given as proposed birthdays of the founder of Christianity. Among them was December 25th, and also, as you will hear, of course, January 6th as well. And eventually, the Western Church, at the end of the 4th century, settled on December 25th, and the Eastern Church never agreed and settled on January 6th. There were two traditions as ultimate finalists, if you like, with regard to what day he was born. Nobody really knew. How could anybody know what day he was born? Nobody kept records. Nobody knew who he would be. You don't have birth dates for even one of the greatest heroes in the first century or the Common Era. So we're back to start. But I'm getting near the end, so I have to come up with something. We'll move on a little longer. Two 19th century witnesses suggest yet another approach, and their testimony demands investigation. The first witness was a great rabbi. His name was Reb Baruch Frankel Teomim, the author of the Baruch Tam, rabbi of Leipnik, greatest rabbinic works of recent history. He died in 1828. And not only did he write the book called Baruch Ham, but he wrote glosses on the Shulchan Aruch. Anyone who gets it, himself or herself, a complete set of the Shulchan Aruch, with all the little commentaries in the back of the Shulchan Aruch, you will have the Hagos of the Baruch, Frankel, Talmud, and the Shulchan Aruch. And on Aruch Haim, it's even called the Pei. The text reads as follows. A little gloss of this rabbi from Arabia. He writes as follows. This is an Ashkenazi. Matosi Kosu Tzavyat. I found a manuscript. He had a manuscript in the 19th century in Leipzig. He had a manuscript. And in the manuscript it said, Shebetes Teves Niftar Shimon HaKalpos. On the ninth day of Teves, Shimon, Simon, HaKalpos, Hey, Kuf Lamed, Hey, Bav Samuk. Shimon HaKalpos died. Shoshia es Yisrael Batzara Gedola, he saved the Jews from a great tragedy. Bizman HaPuritzim, in the days of the sinners, I'll come back to explain that Puritzim is a terminus technicus, you can identify who the sinners are. At a time of great distress for the Jewish people, a certain man by the name of Shimon HaKalpos rescued them. Nikba Yom Misoso, the day of death of this hero, his yahrzeit, became a Tanis Olam, became a permanent fast, Yerushalayim. This was decreed in Yerushalayim. Amazing. I've never heard of this man, his name doesn't occur anywhere else. All we have is this report from the rabbi of Leipzig, recording some event that he found in the manuscript. It was on the ninth day of Teves, and it's a fast. A fast was decreed in memory of this particular person. That's one of these. Well, Bishnayim, Adim, Yapun, Davar. We need a second witness, and I have a second witness. There was a great rabbi, also in the 19th century, who lived in Metz, in Alsace-Lorraine, today in France, who was chief rabbi of Metz, and he was the successor to the Chagas Aryeh. His successor was his Talmud, Reb Aaron Worms, that's his name, W-O-R-M-S, Reb Aaron Worms, and he wrote a book called Mehorei Or, one of the greatest commentaries written on the Talmud in the 19th century. In the Mehorei Or, a copy of which is available in libraries here in New York, in the Mehorei Or, he writes that he found a Sefer Zichronot, he also found a manuscript, some kind of memorial book, perhaps a list of yahrzeits. And this is what his text reads. He says, I found in a manuscript, in the Sefer Zichronot, Raisi al Ptirat Shimon HaKalponi. Not exactly the same, but close enough. We're surely talking about the same person. This refers to Shimon. The other text said HaKalpos. Here it's HaKalponi. Hei Kuflam et Beivav Nunyud. Shehishlim la Yehudim veherimu mipneihem. He somehow made a pact, an agreement with the Jews, and it was hidden from them. You see what these enigmatic words mean. Megillas Tanis, and in the scroll of fast, which means passage 2 that you have in front of you, Nokat Haloshon bo Kosnu Raboseinu Alma. Rabbis did not write why, Mashmahak. This seems to indicate this is what you're referring to. That the name of this famous Jew, Shimon HaKalpos or Shimon HaKalponi, occurs in two different forms suggests that we're dealing with two different records of the event, but it's truly the same event. This name, in either form, occurs nowhere else in all of the Talmudic or rabbinic literature. Not in the Bavli, not in the Yerushalmi, not in the Rishonim, not in the HaKalponi. But it's very easy to identify the person that's being referred to. The reference is to the hero of what's called the Toldot Yeshu literature. We Jews have preserved our own version of the history of Christianity. It's called Toldot Yeshu. It's very hard to get, but it's available. It's available in libraries. We have our own account. The history of Christianity, and we have medieval copies of the text. No one knows when this text was first written. It already certainly existed in the 8th century of the Common Era, and maybe older than that. Then we have already had, it's already cited in non-Jewish literature, a terrible book written by the Jews giving a very different account of the history of the founder of Christianity. This is called Toldot Yeshu. And very briefly, the Toldot Yeshu literature presents a very different view of Christianity. In some ways, a very sympathetic view of Christianity. In any event, what it says is that in the first century, the first Christians were Jews. And they certainly were. The first Christians were Jews. The first Christians were Tallis and Philip, studied Torah. In fact, there was no real way, easy way of distinguishing a Jew from a Christian. Those of you who are in Shas will know there are whole sugyas to talk about this. We have a Birchas Haminim that had to be established. We had to recite a special tefillah so that somehow we could separate ourselves from these other people. And it's been suggested by many of the Parshim that the purpose of the Birchas Haminim, which was in Arshman Esrei, the Moshinim Al-Kisifah, and so on, which was read by Mishnah Adim and so on, had other languages. That was recited because no Jewish Christian would daven for the Yomud, if you have to say Lo Moshiach. See? It was a way of keeping the Christians away from the Yomud. Every rabbi here will understand the problem. Anyway, all right. And there was a crisis in first century Judaism, so according to Toldot Yeshu. It was very difficult outwardly to tell who was a Jew and who was a Jewish Christian. Dressed alike, if you're making a shidduch, you never knew whether you were making a shidduch with someone from a Jewish family or a Jewish Christian family. You were gedolim in the same shul. The person sitting next to you may have been secretly a Jewish Christian because they obeyed all the commandments just like all of the Jews did. Dressed the same way as other Jews. The difference was they believed that Yeshu was the Messiah. But other than that, there were no real social differences or differences in place. Came a tremendous problem. And there's a secret meeting of the Tanaim in the first century. And they don't know what to do. They can't come up with a solution. And finally, one Tana makes a suggestion. He said, look, we have no choice. We're going to have to establish a fifth column. One of us is going to have to join the movement. And one of us will become a member of the Jewish Christian group. And that person will not only become a member, but will become a leader of the Jewish Christian group. And if we can work things out properly, we'll become the leader of the Jewish Christian group. And as leader, someone, it's a fifth column, that person will be able to institute all sorts of new practices that once and for all will solve the problem. In other words, that person will be able to produce the abrogation of the law so that the Jewish Christians will no longer observe mitzvahs. They will become what's known as Gentile Christianity or like Pauline Christianity. The stress will be on the Ten Commandments, the seven Noahide laws, but the ceremonial law, Pesach, Shabbos as we know it, Kiddush and Abdullah and so on, all these practices will be abrogated. And then everyone will know. A Jew, you can tell a Jew if he's Shomer Torah and this is Jewish. Someone who doesn't observe the ceremonial laws, he's a Christian. And the Tanaim go around the room in a circle, they're looking for volunteers, nobody volunteers. And sitting in this group is a Tana by the name of Shimon. Shimon sees there's no other solution, and Shimon volunteers. However, much longer story, I can't go into detail here. He wants a guarantee that he will not lose his share in Olam Haba. Everyone will understand that this is a fifth column, as the Jews will understand. The deal is struck, the Tanaim agree, and he joins the church in Jerusalem, and he becomes Bishop of Jerusalem. And Eusebius, the church father, this is true now, but here we have a fact, not theory. Eusebius, an early church father, writes that the bishop of Jerusalem at this time was someone named Simon HaKalpos. Quite amazing. And here we have these two 19th century witnesses where his name resurfaces. Anyway, in the Toldot Yeshu, this Shimon, we don't have his last name, just Shimon, joins the Jewish Christian group in Eretz Yisrael. since he's a Tana, he's very gifted, as you might imagine. It doesn't take long for him to rise to the top. He becomes bishop of Jerusalem. And not only does he become bishop of Jerusalem, but he is elected pope in Rome. And as pope in Rome, he introduces, if you've heard of Simon Peter, the first pope in Rome was in fact Simon, Shimon. On this rock was in the New Testament, Simon Petrus. So it is Simon, who according to the Toledoian literature, as pope, who introduces Gentile Christianity. He calls for the abrogation of the ceremonial laws. Christians are only supposed to observe the Ten Commandments and the Noahide laws. And once and for all, there are Jews and there are Christians. There is no longer any Jewish Christianity. Nobody's confused. And the day is set. This is the essence of the Toldot Yeshu stories. Now, one manuscript of Toldot Yeshu no longer extant. The manuscript is lost. Before it was lost, it was published. Now I'm holding a published copy of a very rare book. This is called Toldot Yeshu and Otsri. This is one of the Toldot Yeshu versions. This is different from every other manuscript of Toldot Yeshu. It's the most important sealed manuscript of Toldot Yeshu. As the manuscript was lost, but we have a printed edition. It was printed in Holland in 1705. If you look now to the last passage on the page in front of you, this was published by a great scholar of the church named Hulticus, Johann Hulticus in Leiden, 1705. This tells the whole story of Toldot Yeshu, and it says that that bishop of Jerusalem who became pope, his name was Shimon HaKalponi. Here we have the last name. And then it says on page 126, and you have the passage in front of you, Yamat Shimon, Shimon died. This is the Hebrew version. This is our text, Toldot Yeshu. This is only for our eyes. Yamat Shimon, Vaydabu Bnei Yisrael, Shimon, Vekavu, Yomi Tato, Litanot, Bechol Shana, Veshana, Vehu Tet Yamin, Yerach Nid. Died, and they made his day a fast day, all time, the ninth day. Yes.
You said this
version
is different from all other versions?
Yeah, different in detail.
Do we have any other versions?
Oh, sure, absolutely. We have other versions. The other versions are extant. Each version represents a different manuscript. This represents a manuscript, but this no other version has the name Shimon HaKalponi or Shimon HaKalponi. Now, as I say, this was published in 1705, and here we have what seems to me rather clearly the true explanation for this fast, and of course why the rabbis couldn't spell out why we fast on this day. We fast on a day where we celebrate a hero who saved the day for us. He saved Judaism by separating Judaism from Jewish Christianity. Once it's a very dangerous book because, in effect, what this book really says is, well, no, our Christianity succeeded, but it was us. We arranged it that way. All right. Now, as a historian, and now I come forward as a historian, there is a very important problem that we need to address here. We began with a very difficult passage from the 8th century of the Common Era, that's passage 2 that you have in front of you, which talks about a fast day of the ninth day of Tammuz. And where did I find an explanation for this passage that I'm now investing all my money in? In a book published in 1705. Now, methodologically, you can't do that. This manuscript is lost. You don't have this manuscript. All we have is the 1705 version. I can't use a manuscript printed in 1705 as evidence for what was understood in the 8th century. It's a huge gap between the 8th century of the Common Era and the 18th century, beginning of the 18th century, 1705. That's the problem I have. My problem is, how am I going to somehow prove that this text is really an early text. That this text, even though it was printed for the first time in 1705, if I had the manuscript, I might be able to prove it by radiocarbon dating, but I don't have the manuscript. I only have the printed edition. if you read this entire text, the book of this, there's mention here of the Rhine Valley. There's mention in here in the first century that before the Tanoim wanted to make a decision as what to do, they decided that this was a matter of such great import that Jews the world over had to be consulted. This could not be a decision that could be done only by the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. And so they send out letters to the Jewish community in Babel that already existed in the first century. And they send out letters to Rome. And they send out letters to the Rhine Valley. And for many years it was known there wasn't. And the Jewish settlers who came along with the Romans, the Gorms, the Mainz, these were not founded in. And it actually mentions, Vorm, the city Vorms is mentioned here, and in fact that a letter went from Yerushalayim consulting with Vorms, with its great rabbinic leaders, to see whether they agree that this should be done, and they agree. All that's described here in this text. Also described in this text, and now I want you to listen carefully, is the following. And I'm actually just going to read what it says. How did this Shimon HaKalpos managed to persuade Christians to become what we call Gentile Christianity or Pauline Christianity, that is, to abrogate the law. So this text says, Simon resided in the Tower of Rome. I'm translating some of the Hebrew text now to save time, where he ordained and codified the Christian laws and customs, and he did as he was commanded to do by the sages of Judea. He transformed the alphabet, giving the letters new names, thereby intimating to those in on the secret that what he was ordaining was false. And this was the new alphabet that he created for Christianity. A, B, C, D, E, F. Follows the Latin alphabet. He also composed for them many books. He called them Evangelium. He composed books that are part of the New Testament. And in these books, he composed the Pauline epistles, if you like, which teach the abrogation of the law.
It's amazing.
I never seen anywhere else where it ever said that a Jew invented the alphabet. But what do you know about medieval Christianity? What was the language of medieval Christianity? Latin. Every document was written in Latin. The Bible was read in Latin and studied in Latin, which was why the priests were in control. The average person could not read Latin. Jews did not read Latin by and large either. So he created a secret religion. And because he kept that religion secret, and only the priests knew the Latin, only they knew the teachings, and the teachings were the separation of Jews and Christians and so on. Here it says that it was this Jew who established the alphabet that became the alphabet of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, we read a Rashi, why don't you go to Ben, I'm going to come into the end. Go back to passage 1. You read a very difficult Rashi. Remember I asked the question, why does Rashi say others wrote their books for them? That Rashi is a censored Rashi. It's what's printed in every edition of Shas. But our printed editions of the Talmud are censored. You have to get yourself an uncensored copy of the Talmud and an uncensored Rashi. I just happen to have a copy of it. And I'm going to read in translation what the uncensored text of Rashi reads. You'll find this in any El HaMakoros Shas, those of you who have it, again, a Popsky Shas, or you'll find it in any edition of Hidukei Sofrim. There is a multi-volume work which has all the varied readings and the censored passage of Shas, either of the two books that I just mentioned, and only in the two books that I just mentioned. Again, either the Dukei Sofrim or the Genapovsky edition of Shas, which is available in print, you will find the uncensored text in Russian. Maybe I ought to go back at least to the Hebrew words of Russian so you can see what the text really said. Hold page 1 in front of you, passage 1 in front of you. Rashi Bibura Maschil Ksav Lashon, it ends with Acherim Tiknu Lahem Kol Sifrehem. Right? The uncensored text continues. I'm going to pass around the Hebrew so you can look at it. I never take my work for anything. I don't take anybody else's work for anything. But I'll read a an English translation of what it is. It starts exactly as our Rashi. It ends exactly the last words of Rashi. Others wrote their books for that. Remember, we saw that that was a very difficult passage. There was nothing in the text that required that. But for Rashi, when he read this passage in the Gemara, remember the verse talks about Edom, and Edom is Rome, and who is Rome identified with by the time we get to Rashi? Rome is Christianity. Rashi understands the Gemara is referring to the Holy Roman Empire, its rulers, and its kings. And Rashi says, they don't have a language. You know why Edom, Rome, Christianity doesn't have a language? Because that the script of Rome, the Latin that they use in their church that was instituted by a Jew. And not only that, others wrote their books for them. And now I'm going to read the text as I have it in one version, one uncensored version of Rashi. The script and the language of the Romans were borrowed from another nation. Others wrote their books for them, namely John, Paul, and Simon Peter. All of them Jews. Language refers to grammatica, the Latin spoken by priests. They, the Jews, transformed the language of the Romans into an obscure one in order to separate them from Israel. They, the Jews, were not apostates. Rather, they acted from the best of intentions so as to benefit the Jews. They saw that the Jews were oppressed by the deceitful acts of the followers of Jesus. They impersonated priests and ordained all the Christian laws and customs and books, as is stated explicitly in the Kliyat Yeshu narrative. What does Rashi say? How does Rashi know all this? Where did Rashi know all this from? As it is stated explicitly in Kliyat Yeshu. Rashi had the Kliyat Yeshu narrative. He has our story as it's told in his book published in 1795. What do I know now? I now know that this book that was first printed in 1705 was already available and circulating in the time of Rashi. Once I can push it back to, Rashi was born 1040, died 1105, I can push it back to the 11th century, then I have no problem whatsoever. And now assuming that the author of our list of facts, in fact, knew about the ninth of Tevet, he also had a copy of this publication text. Eric told you that in general, publication was already cited earlier. Literature. He had a copy of the text, knew about this fast day, and incorporated in the list of fast days, but couldn't explain why. So this is all quite amazing, and yes?
The Lodge of Clubs, that Matthias, one of the descendants of Edom, was the first Christian. Where did he get that?
One of all part of this medieval, even earlier than medieval period. As I said before, the rabbis identified Edom, which is really a biblical nation, even